Welcome to another edition of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird, as usual. Chad, how are you doing this morning?
I am very good. Very good. Eager to get back into the story of Genesis and see what drama awaits us next.
Awesome. Yeah, we got some new equipment going on now. We fixed some issues, so we should be back on the regular schedule. We had some failures, but we've fixed them and we're ready to go. So why don't we jump right in here?
All right, let's do it. So we are going to be at the start of chapter 46 of Genesis. Just to kind of recap what happened last in the story, we've been in the Joseph narrative for several weeks now, and in the previous chapter in Genesis 45, we finally have Joseph revealing himself to his brothers after this long period of him pretending to be somebody that he's not. He reveals who he actually is, that he is their own flesh and blood. We have a tearful reunion between him and his brothers, forgiveness, reconciliation, all of those good things. The brothers return home after this. They have all of these presents from Joseph to give to their father, along with the best present of all, and that is the good news that, in fact, after all these years of thinking that his favorite son was dead, he is, in fact, alive. So when they get home, they tell Jacob, their old father, Joseph is still alive, and not only that, but he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. So they tell him this, he's stunned, he doesn't believe them at first, and as the words gradually sink in, it says that the spirit of their father Jacob revived. So it's almost like a resurrection in his old age, where after all these years of dealing with grief and missing his son, all of a sudden he realizes the son is alive, and not only that, but waiting for him down in the land of Egypt. So this is the way the chapter finishes off. It says, then Israel said, it is enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. So we have Israel and all his sons and all their children and the grandchildren. All of this great clan of Israel or Jacob ready to go down into Egypt. This is really a turning point in the story of the Torah, because it's at this point that we are going to really enter into a new phase in the history. Before this, most of the action has been taking place in the Holy Land. It's beginning already in the 12th chapter of Genesis. Abraham and Sarah, they arrive in the land that God promised to give to Abraham, and Abraham stays there, and his son Isaac stays there. And then Isaac has Jacob and Esau, and Jacob is gone for a while, but he returns there. So most of the action so far in Genesis, at least from chapter 12 through chapter 45, has been centered in the Holy Land. But now we're going to move. And the action from Genesis 46 all the way through the rest of the Pentateuch, all the way through really the end of Deuteronomy, is going to take place elsewhere. First, it's going to take place in Egypt, where we're heading next. And then after that, in the Exodus from Egypt, it's going to take place for 40 years in the wilderness. So there's a huge shift in geography and a huge shift really in what's going to be happening with the people of God from this point on. And that's what we're really going to get into here at the beginning of chapter 46, where I want to talk about exile and God's presence or absence in exile and a few other things related to that these verses are going to bring up for us. So I think what I'll do, first of all, is just read you these first four verses of Genesis 46, and then I want to go back and talk about a few details that are either explicit or implicit in these verses. So this is Genesis 46, 1 through 4. It says, so Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here I am. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will close your eyes. So one of the first things that I think we should mention here, and it's sort of a subtle thing, but I think it's also significant. You remember that when we started out this story about Jacob, that was his name. It was called Jacob. And when he wrestled with God on the banks of the Jabbok River, and God let him win, then he was given a new name. He was given the name Israel, which means he who strives with God, or he who fights with God. And from that point on, Jacob has a kind of a dual name. And we see in the chapters leading up to this that it'll go back and forth. Sometimes he's called Jacob, sometimes he's called Israel. But here I think it's significant that the name that is used is Israel. It says God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. So we kind of have both names going on here in this story. But it's significant because what happens is that this one man, whom we have known as Jacob and whom we now know as Israel, he becomes kind of the embodiment of the entire nation. So Jacob, in his own person, represents all of the nation of Israel. So he's not just Israel the man, but he's also Israel the nation. So that when you see him, you see really the one who's going to be the stand-in or the representative of all of the family that's associated with him. And the reason that's important is because what's about to happen to this one man, Israel, is what's going to happen to the entire nation of Israel. So this one man is going to go down with all of his people into Egypt and remain there for the next approximately 400 years, something like that. So that's the first thing that I think we should point out. The second is he sets out with all that he has, and he comes to this place that we've met before. It's called Beersheba, or in Hebrew, Be'er Sheva. It means Be'er is a well. So Be'er Sheva is the well of seven, or the well of swearing. Either one of those translations will work. And we met this a couple of times, actually, the most significant of which was Jacob's father, Isaac, was at Beersheba, and he built an altar there. So Isaac built an altar at Beersheba, and now it's to this altar that Jacob is going to go before he leaves the Holy Land, and there he's going to offer sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. Now, let's pause there for just a second and think about this. So this is the climactic moment in Israel's history as a nation, and in Israel's history as Jacob, because he is about to go really into what you might think of as his second exile. He's already been in exile in Paddan Aram after he had to flee from his brother Esau. He was in exile there for a long time, for 20 years, came back with his whole family, his two wives, his two co-wives, all of his sons and his daughter. So he's already been in exile again. He came back. He was established in the Holy Land. And now that he's an old man, he's going to have to leave again. And not only is he going to have to leave again, but he's going to die in exile as well. So before he does this, before he finally says goodbye to the Holy Land, he stops to offer sacrifices. And he offers sacrifices, no doubt, on the same altar that his father had built. Now, what's significant about the Hebrew word behind sacrifices here? It's not the common word used in Genesis for sacrifices. These are the sacrifices that the worshiper would partake of himself. If you've ever looked at the sacrifices, like in Leviticus or in Exodus, You notice there's all kinds. There's the whole burnt offerings, there's peace offerings, there's guilt offerings, there's sin offerings, there's just all sorts of different kinds of sacrifices. Now, some of these were, you put like the whole animal on top of the altar, and it would be completely consumed by the fire. That was called the whole burnt offering, or an olah, which means to go up. So the whole animal would go up in smoke to God. So an olah, or a whole burnt offering. In those cases, the worshiper got none of the animal. But in some of them, such as those that are mentioned here, there was actually sort of a communal sacred meal that accompanied these sacrifices. So what would happen in this kind of sacrifice is that the worshiper would present an animal to the Lord, and most of it would be offered up on the altar. But then part of the animal would be given back to the worshiper, and then they have an old-fashioned Israelite barbecue in which they would cook the animal, and then they would share it in this communal meal with all the other worshipers. So that's the kind of sacrifice we have here. Now, what I love about these kinds of sacrifices is that not only are you worshiping God, but you are partaking. You are taking into your own body that which has been sanctified, made holy by the altar, by God, so that you are receiving into yourself holiness. So the sacrifice is holy. When you eat it, you are holied. You are made holy by that which you consume. And I love the way that God set up these sacrifices this way, because God is not saying simply, hey, give me everything. God is saying, offer the sacrifice, and then from this, you take part of that sacrifice so that you really are going to eat my holiness. You're going to partake of my holiness. And this is the way that I am assuring you that you're my people, giving you my love and my protection, and even filling you with my own holiness so that you are as I am, so that you're holy just like I am. So it was a way in which God solidified his bond with his people. And this is the perfect time for this to happen, because what's about to take place? Well, Jacob's about to leave the Holy Land, and so he's taking holiness with him.
Yeah, you know, it's too bad that there's nothing in the New Testament that, like, corresponds to that.
Yeah, I mean, just think, maybe, what if there was like, in the New Testament, maybe, I don't know, let's say there was a supper, a meal.
that was made holy.
Yeah, it was made holy, and by consuming it, we ourselves ate and drank the very cost of our redemption.
You know, one of the things I hear now, you know, some people might think this is a stretch, I don't know, I don't care.
Go for it.
I have passages. Now, of course, as a pastor, I'm the one administering the communion. So,
yeah,
right. So you know, there's words of institution to be said, and take, eat, this is the true body of our Lord, broken for you, this sort of thing. But while I'm saying this stuff, I've always got verses rattling around in my head. I always have the voice of Jesus rattling around in my head on certain things. And a couple of these things are, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood, I will raise him up on the last day. That sort of thing is like rattling around in my head. Another thing, though, and that's sort of, that makes sense. You're like, well, yeah, that's understandable. But
sure,
maybe one that's a bigger stretch is, be holy as I am holy. Which, if, and like, so people read that and they think like, oh, I better go be holy.
Yeah, I better get to work.
Yeah,
right.
But if you look at the Greek, it's more like this: you will be holy because I am holy. That's what's going on there, and that's rattling around my head, because I know since I will be holy because he's holy, and because he is holy, and this is his body and blood, I too am going to be holy as he's holy. There's an exchange happening there. Like, here's my holiness. Like, you, so do this and be holy.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on there. God gives that which he speaks. So when he talks about us being holy, then he gives us that holiness. That's one thing that seems to be forgotten in a lot of churches that holiness is not achieved, it is always received. Holiness is always a gift. It always comes from the hand of God, and it always comes as a result of grace. So sanctification is not something that we make happen. It's something that happens to us. God sanctifies us. God makes us holy. And the way that he does that is by giving us holy things. He puts his holy name on us in baptism, and therefore we're holy. He feeds us his holy body and gives us his holy blood, and therefore we're holy. So holiness is almost kind of contagious. You get it from physical contact. And you certainly have that in the supper. You get holiness from what you consume. And the thing is, and that's the reason I pointed this out back in Genesis 46, is that this isn't something new. This has always been the way that God has worked. So he is the only one who is holy. So anybody or anything else that's holy is so because of their connection to God. That's the only way. So it's not like, you know, we can work toward holiness on the basis of our own efforts and somehow achieve it. No, holiness is always given. It's always a gift. And here it was through sacrifices. With us, it's through being baptized, hearing his word, receiving himself in the Holy Supper. All of these things are the means by which God makes us holy, which is to say, he puts us in intimate connection with himself, and by that connection, we are made holy. That's the way that God works.
You know, I don't know how many fans of like contemporary worship, and I'm a worship snob, so I mean, don't read too much into what I'm about to say, but there is a more modern song, and maybe you don't love all of this song, or maybe you hate this song. You know, I don't know, but oddly enough, it's written by a Catholic who's writing like modern worship songs, which is I find kind of funny. But there's a stanza in the song "Lord, I Need You," which is written by Matt Maher. I don't know if he's speaking to the supper or not. Maybe he is a Catholic after all. But there's a stanza that I think of communion when I hear it all the time, where he says, "Where sin runs deep, your grace is more. Grace is found where you are, and where you are, I am free. Holiness is Christ in me." And I'm usually like, yep, that's right.
That's good. Holiness is Christ in me. That's perfect. That's perfect. Yeah.
Correct.
We are holy because Christ is in us. That's as straightforward as it gets. That's a great case of a great instance of truth being expressed clearly and succinctly in the church's song. So here's Israel. Here's Jacob. He's about to leave the Holy Land. And so he stops and he offers sacrifices. He doesn't do this because, I better be obedient to God and make him happy by offering a sacrifice. No, he does this in order that he might partake of God's gifts, God's holiness, as he gets ready to embark on this journey away from the Promised Land. So that's the first thing I wanted to point out. As we go on, so he offers sacrifices, and then God speaks. So he offers the sacrifices, and then God begins to talk in visions of the night. God has a thing for appearing to people at night. We see this, or in darkness of some sort, we see this very frequently throughout the scriptures. In fact, Jacob might have recalled the nighttime theophany, appearance of God that he experienced on the banks of the Jabbok River when he wrestled with him. So this is not wrestling, but this is speaking. He says, "Jacob, Jacob." And he says, "Here I am." And then he goes on to say that I'm God, the God of your father. I'm going to be with you. Now, the thing I want to point out here is, I think, most significant about this revelation is this is the last revelation of God to the patriarchs. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the patriarchs. And God appeared to Abraham. He appeared to Isaac. He's appeared multiple times to Jacob, and this is the last one. And not only that, this is pretty amazing, I think. This is going to be the last time that God appears and speaks to his people for the next 400 years. Now, just kind of let this sink in. Throughout the Old Testament, this gap between God's revelation to his people, between this one here to Jacob, and the next time it's going to happen is when God appears to Moses in the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. So between Genesis 46 and Exodus 3, about 400 years takes place. This is the longest period of divine silence in the Old Testament. So this revelation happens, and then the next revelation is to Moses at the burning bush. Now, why is this important? Well, I think it's important because, first of all, it's not the way that we would expect God to work. Now, you would think that when things get really bad, when things get really dark, when life starts kind of throwing everything at you, or when life itself, you know, kind of falls apart and you find yourselves, you know, sitting among the ruins of your broken life, you would think that that would be the time when God would say the most to you, if you will, reveal himself to you, really seem present to you. And yet that's not the way it is. It's when we would think that we really need this kind of divine appearance is when he seems most absent. Now you think about Israel. Israel is about to go into a land that's not their own. So they're going to be exiles, which is never easy. Not only that, but while they're there, they are going to be enslaved by the Egyptians. And not only that, but at a certain point in their history, they're going to have their children ripped from their arms when they're born, and the boys are going to be thrown into the Nile River. So there's going to be not only exile and not only enslavement, but their children are going to be murdered before their eyes. All of this is going to befall Israel in the next few generations. And yet, despite that, there will be no divine revelation from this point all the way until Exodus chapter 3. Now, the reason that I think this is so important to point out is it's not just a case of, oh, that's kind of interesting, trivial fact about something from the Old Testament, but because this is exactly the way that it still works in our lives. I'm betting, I know this has happened with Dan and me, but I'm betting that everybody who's listening to this has at some point in their life experienced the personal equivalent of an Egyptian exile. They have felt cut off. They felt abandoned. They felt nothing but darkness. They felt like they're enslaved to something. Maybe it's drugs. Maybe it's alcohol. Maybe it's sex. Maybe it's depression. Whatever it is, you feel like you're basically in bondage to something. And it's at that point when it would be really nice for God to appear to you and say something like, hey, I'm with you. Everything's going to be okay. But that doesn't happen. In fact, it often feels like God has become your enemy. It's at those times that we realize that what we need are not new revelations, but old promises. So we don't need God to appear to us. Instead, what happens is God directs us back to the promises that he has always given to us in his word. That's kind of what he's teaching us through these trials and tribulations and sufferings of darkness, is that he has given us his word, and his word remains true, and his word promises that he is with us, that he will sustain us, that he will get us through this, that no matter what happens, no matter how heavy the cross is, that he is right there by our side, just as he was for the Egyptians.
I've never had anything like that happen to me, no.
I know, just kind of pretend that okay. Maybe something like this. Pretend that you've had your own personal Egyptian exile.
You know,
what do you think that'd be like?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting I mean, if you're just reading this narrative, you know, you see all this like bad stuff happen to Joseph, and you, maybe you're still sort of remembering the promises made to Abraham, and then you remember, like, you know, what a chump Jacob was, but then he seems to, you know, he got things reconciled with his brother, it seemed, and things are working out, but then his sons are kind of punks, and they do this horrible stuff to Joseph, and then there's a famine, and Joseph has all this horrible stuff happen to him, but he gets raised up, and then the brothers reunite, and there's reconciliation there, and here comes Jacob to be reunited with his son, and you're like, all right, the happy ending is upon us.
Yeah, let the fireworks begin.
Like, all right, like the promises made to Abraham are coming together now. Like, it's happening, and lo and behold, no.
Yeah. Lo and behold, you had to leave the very country that you wanted your family all to be in, right?
Not only that, but even leaving the country to go to another country, you might be like, well, it's going to be sweet. Now things are going to really start like working out, because we got one of us. We got a descendant of Abraham in a powerful position.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the wheels have begun to turn to us being established as a great nation. The like things are in. We have a guy in a position to, we can really work with this. And no, that is not going to be the case. I don't think that you, if you're reading this and you don't know, I don't think, it's hard to do because we do know, but if you didn't know and you're reading this, you're not thinking, oh, the next part of this is like a couple generations of slavery and like horrific, you know, horrific manual labor and murder and death. Like, no, doesn't seem the way this is going at all. It seems that this divinely orchestrated plan is like finally culminating into this good thing. No, this is gonna like take a hard right into like a lot of crappiness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think reading the biblical narrative has ruined me in some ways. because we have this up and down, you know, this mountaintop and valley. I was reading a novel recently and everything seemed to be going really well, and I kept waiting for it to fall apart as the story progressed. I kept thinking, no, next chapter, a disaster is going to wipe them all out. Because that seemed to be the way that it happens in the biblical story. Well, it didn't happen that way in the novel. But that's what happens in the Bible. And, well, that's the way it usually happens in our lives, too. You know, we have times of light and darkness, good and bad, and everything in between. But you're exactly right. At least if we didn't know the story, we would think that everything, that, well, Israel finally had it made. I mean, it'd be like having, you know, your brother in the White House. Well, you know, you can always call on him. He's going to help you out. But that didn't last very long.
And you certainly don't think like that. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, Joseph's not going to be in power forever, but I mean, but our family will at least be distinguished in the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to become slaves.
Right. That would have been the last thought in their mind.
Come on, man. Like, that's not on your radar.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, already back, way back in the early chapters of the Abraham story, we had this prophesied, although without specifics. Abraham was told that his descendants would be enslaved in a foreign land. We weren't told where or when this would happen, but it was prophesied. So this is kind of the beginning of that fulfillment, although I doubt very, very highly that Jacob and his sons realized that at the moment. But now let's talk about this a little bit more, because God says, don't be afraid to go down into Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely also bring you up again. Now, this also is completely unexpected, because if God is going to make Israel a great nation somewhere, then why doesn't he do that in the Holy Land? Instead, he does it in exile. He does it in the very place where they're really not supposed to be, in the non-promised land, in the land where they're strangers, where they're foreigners, where they eventually become oppressed and enslaved. It's at that point where they are deprived of virtually everything, including their freedom, that God makes him into a great nation. And this is a fantastic opportunity to point out the backwards ways that God tends to work. Because to relate this to our own life, I mean, I always think, even though I know better, I always think that God is going to do his best work in my life when things are going really well for me. I always think that, even though I'm 46 years old, I have some life experience behind me, and I know the scriptures, I still find myself swallowing this assumption that God is going to do his best work in my life when things are going really well for me, even though I know that's really not the case. Now, I'm not saying that he can't do things in my life when everything is going well. Of course he can. But the fact remains that most of the time, God does his best work in our life when things are not going well, when we're struggling, or when we're suffering, or when we're fighting something, or whenever what's happening doesn't seem to be good, God is right in the thick of that to work grace and healing and humility and all the things that he does, because that's the kind of God that he is. He always hides himself under his opposite. So when it seems that God is most absent is when he's most present. When he seems that he's not doing any work, he's working. I read some time ago a book that talked about how, you know, when we can't see God at work in someone's life, it's most likely when he's most at work in their life. And I think that is the truth.
Well,
that's the theology of the cross, right?
Oh yeah. Well, I think the God, this becomes a cliche, but it's actually a promise. So it stands, no matter how many coffee cups it's been put on. But God working all things together for good is not necessary to say that if, okay. So that statement implies that God works bad things together for good, because that statement is not necessary if God works good things together for good. Yeah, well, all right.
Sure.
That's not like really a promise I need. I feel like he is working good things together for good when things are good. You know, there's not like, well, you know, everything,
that, right?
Everything's perfect. God's probably, you know, he probably worked this out. No, I'm not like, no, it's when things are like in the gutter that I'm like, this seems horrible. This seems absolutely horrific. It's in that I need that word that says, yeah, I'm working all things.
Mm-hmm.
Not like these things together for good. And so, yeah, I think that you see that throughout the entire biblical narrative that God is taking bad situations. I mean, like, and let's just be real. Like, he's taking people's sinful actions and working them and weaving them together toward his ultimate plan, his ultimate good, the good that he has planned. He's taking those things and paving the road with them that will lead you into what it is that he has prepared. Doesn't mean that like everything ends up awesome for you. I mean, we're about to see generations where it doesn't, but his promises to Abraham about his offspring will come to pass, even though a great many of the people, it will not seem like that at all for their entire life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exile, whatever form that exile might take, whether it's through sin or through addiction or through loss or through divorce or through whatever the tragedies of life might be that put us in this state of exile, that's where we need the promise of God's presence. And that's where we have it. It's like that for Israel. It's like that for us too. So it's in this exile that God makes Israel into the nation that he wants him to be, despite their sufferings, despite their enslavement, despite everything that they've gone through. It's there that he is with them to bless them and to make them great. And the reason is, and this brings us to the fourth verse, the reason is because he says, I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will close your eyes. This might be one of my top 10 favorite passages in the Old Testament. Genesis 46, verse 4, because God endures a self-imposed exile with his people. He says, I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. So this exile that Israel is about to endure is an exile that God will endure with them. He will be present with them. He will suffer with them. And he will bring them up finally again to the land that he's promised to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. So no matter what the exile is, no matter what the reason for the exile, whether in the biblical narrative or in our own lives, God is present there. It's not as if he simply says, all right, you know, I've got you outfitted. I've trained you. You're ready to go. Now go into exile, and eventually you can come back, and I'll be here waiting for you. No, God says, I'm going with you. He's kind of like the divine Ruth, right? We all know this Ruth quote about where she says to Naomi, you know, your God is my God, and my God is your God. Where you go, I'm going to go with you. Well, that's the way God is. Where you go, I'm going to be with you. It doesn't matter what the exile is. I'm present in that exile with you. In fact, I just found this passage this morning in Ezekiel chapter 11, verse 16, where God tells Israel, this is centuries later, but when he sent them into exile because of their sin, he says, I was for a little while a sanctuary to them in the lands where I had scattered them. So even though God sent Israel into exile in later years to Babylon and to Assyria, even there, in those exiles, God was a sanctuary, a holy place, a place of protection for them in the midst of everything that they were going through. It's a fantastic image that God has not kind of stationed himself in one place and he sends his people off to suffer whatever they are going to suffer, and then he'll be waiting for them when they get back. No, he goes with them. He travels with them, he lives with them, he suffers with them, and he brings them back. It's kind of like a whole picture of crucifixion and resurrection, if you will. God is saying, I'm going to go into the cross and into the tomb with you, and I will bring you out again, because that, in fact, is what I have done for you in my Son. Just as he was crucified and buried and raised, so when you're bearing your crosses and you're going through your valleys of the shadow of death, I will be there to suffer with you and to travel with you and to bear your burdens and finally to bring you out on the other side, because I'm the God who goes into exile with you and the God who brings you home from exile as well.
I think that it's also interesting that he makes a promise and then he's silent through the exile and the suffering. And I think that that's often the case, that we ask, like, where is God? And Israel is going to ask that question. But much like as Christ suffered, you know, he remained silent as a lamb. He opened not his mouth, right? I think a lot of times in our suffering, it's that way too. We have a promise, and God suffers with us, but he's silent. That God is often silent in suffering. He was silent in his own suffering, and he's silent in the things that he suffers with us. But but not on the front end. We have his promises that says that he will deliver us, that he will not leave us or forsake us, that he's going to bring us to a good place. We have all that, but those things aren't necessarily spoken to us over and over again by God in the midst of it. Much of that is silent. But it doesn't mean he's not there, as we see in this text. He is there, but God suffers silently. But he does always as well make promises on the front end of it that he always delivers on.
And that's a good place to wrap everything up.
That's it. We're out of time. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining us. Hey, coming up very soon, like a month, at CHF Dallas. You can come hang out. You can still register. You can go over to ChristWillFast.org, go to the city events page. You can come hang out with me and Chad and a bunch of other people in Dallas. We're going to talk about parables. We're going to talk about the greatest storyteller of all time. So that should be a blast. And just come hang out. We'd love to see you. So if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, bring it on. If you go to a church around there, tell your church to bring the whole church or as many people that want to come down. Or if you don't live around there and you just want to road trip it or jump on a plane, that'll work too. I know some people are doing that, and that's awesome. I couldn't believe how many people were actually flying in for it. So, yeah, come hang out with us. Information's on the site. If you'd like to support this, if you'd like to support that, if you want to support any of the stuff that we do, you can go over to ChristWillFast.org, go to the support page, and you can make a one-time donation or a reoccurring donation. And thank you so much for those of you who do that. That really does make all this stuff possible. And we have lots of stuff that we'd like to do, and it all takes a little bit of funding. So the more help we get, the more stuff we are able to do. All right. That being said, we will see you guys next week.